From Capital Broadcasting Company and WRAL.com, this is The Wrap at NC Capital.
Good afternoon. Welcome to our weekly edition of The Wrap. I'm Laura Leslie, WRAL Capital Bureau Chief.
And I'm Travis Stain, WRAL State House Reporter.
And Travis, it has been a while since we've done one of these. And I will also explain up front, I apologize to the bandage for the folks who are watching the video. The big old bandage on the side of my head because I have a little skin cancer. Not so little actually taken off of my ear this week. And so believe me, it looks better with the bandage on than not. So anyway, thank you for your forbearance. But otherwise, it has been a very, very busy week, Travis. I mean, especially for kind of the beginning of August is usually sort of the doldrums, especially in an election year.
Yeah, it's kind of been lawsuit week. You know, we had today there were arguments, and we're taping this on Thursday. We should note instead of Friday as normal. There were arguments today in NAACP versus State Board of Elections. That's the one targeting the touchscreen voting. And it looks like we could get a ruling in that next week, the judge said. There were about 3 hours of arguments today. And so I think there's 21 counties or so that are still using the touch screens. They print out a ballot at the end of the voting process, but you're still voting by touchscreen. So we could find out whether or not those counties have to replace those things. And, you know, Forrest v. Cooper over shutdown orders, that was in court. And... we got a federal ruling on absentee voting rules and other voting rules, so we can kind of tick through all that.
Right, and so the federal lawsuit and the NAACP, the touchscreen, I think, what was their argument about it? The touchscreen was difficult for people, that people who had to vote touchscreen couldn't vote safely without touchscreen?
It's an argument that's kind of multiplied because of the pandemic. Back a year or two ago, whenever the State Board of Elections first approved these touchscreens, there were some arguments made by a number of entities, including the NAACP, that, you know, they're hackable or they're just not as safe as a paper ballot.
Right.
And then they've kind of expanded that with the pandemic to say, well, they're also, you know, potentially COVID-19 could be on the surface and you pick it up with your hand and then you touch your face. Surface transmission is not near the risk that we maybe once thought it was, perhaps when this suit was filed.
Right.
But you know, the risk is not necessarily zero. So they were kind of adding that argument on top of just a general dislike of these touchscreen voting machines, which I think Mecklenburg County has spent something like $10 million to, because they had to replace their old touchscreens that didn't produce a paper ballot with touchscreens that do produce a paper ballot. So, you know, there's a lot of money on the line here, including for a company called ES&S, which makes these machines.
And then, refresh my memory. Isn't there also a lawsuit out there right now from the disability rights people arguing about the rights or the ability of folks who can't see, blind voters, to vote absentee ballots without assistance?
So there are at least 9 different lawsuits that affect voting laws in some way right now, and they're at various stages and in various courts. That sounds right. But what I'm not certain of is if that is its own lawsuit or if that is an argument within a broader lawsuit.
I think it's its own lawsuit, but I'm not entirely sure. And I apologize for not knowing that. It is hard to keep these all straight. That other lawsuit that we mentioned that you were talking about, Cooper and Forrest, that has to do, well, that's not voting. So let's go back to the other voting one, which was also that was this week as well, right?
Yeah, this is one of the federal cases. You'll remember that when we covered, what was it, the April session? One of these recent sessions, a pretty bipartisan, broadly supported bill passed that changed a number of laws, kind of loosened absentee ballot laws. There are a number of groups that said that they didn't go far enough to really make it easy to vote absentee if you don't want to go in person to the polls. This was brought by, I can't remember all the entities, but Allison Riggs with the Southern Coalition of Social Justice, which of course has been involved in a lot of the landmark voting lawsuits in this state in recent years. They were involved in it. And long story short, the judge didn't make all the changes they wanted, but he did make one change they wanted, which is if they're going to reject your absentee ballot because the signature doesn't look right or you didn't fill out all the witness information right, something's wrong like that, then they have to reach out to you and give you a chance to contest it exactly what that'll look like is a process the state's going to have to come up with. But that's kind of what the advocates behind the lawsuit are looking to as a victory. And Republicans who have, you know, written most of these laws, all of them really, they're also kind of looking at it as a victory because most of what these folks wanted, they didn't get. They wanted like secure drop boxes where you could drive to the local office and drop it in there instead of putting it in the mail, because the mail is a concern right now with all the budget cuts at the post office, the problems they're having. And the other big thing they wanted was an extension of the voter registration deadline. Right now it runs out 25 days before the election. They wanted the judge to force that forward. But the judge did some strong language in this opinion saying, look, you guys got to take this seriously. Even the things that I didn't do, if you don't, you're going to regret it, basically. I mean, not clear exactly what that means, but admonishing the state, I would say, to really focus in on how we're going to vote in November.
And fairly so. I mean, because, you know, we've been watching these absentee ballot request numbers come in. Michael Bitzer down at Catawba College has done a really great job at analyzing some of these numbers and trends. And, you know, I think we were running somewhere 6 to 7 times above the number of requests that we had in 2016. And they're saying at this point, it could be anywhere from 30 to 40% of voters who decide to use the absentee ballot up from the normal 4 or 5%. And it can be kind of confusing. There's all the different lines for witnesses, and you got to sign here, you got to sign there. And so there certainly is an argument to be made, I'm sure, as the judge found, to give folks a chance to go back and fix it if they didn't do something right on that, that shouldn't necessarily disqualify their vote. So
it is complicated. And what I've been telling people, and what I'll reiterate here, is that you need a voting plan. Like, you need to put some thought into, okay, here's how I'm going to vote. Here's when I'm going to vote. If it's going to be absentee, do it early so that if the mail is delayed, and probably most of the people that listen to this podcast, you know, are fairly sophisticated politically. So congratulations, ladies and gentlemen, for that designation. But I bet you know people who aren't necessarily, and who could use a little friendly advice, a little friendly nudge. It's real easy to get confused between what an absentee ballot request form is versus an absentee ballot. And like you said, the witness requirement, there's some rigmarole to it, and we don't need rigmarole to be stopping democracy in this country.
In the meantime, some other things, as we were mentioning, the Cooper Forest lawsuit, that had to do with whether or not the Constitution or statute required the governor to get the concurrence or approval of the Council of State before he issued those shutdown orders. Forrest and Republicans obviously arguing, yes, he did need to get it and he didn't. And Cooper arguing that statute has sort of different parts that allow for different things. And he did this particular shutdown order under the public health for which he does not have to get concurrence. Is that about right? Did we get a sense of when they're going to rule on that?
I did not get it quickly, I think. The judge made it clear that he would expect it to be appealed, and that, you know, kind of time is of the essence. And when the arguments were being held, we were paused in phase two, but with an announcement imminent whether we would go to phase three. And of course, the governor has now announced we will continue to stay in phase two, which means bars and bowling alleys, entertainment venues, gyms remain closed. I mean, those are kind of the big, there are a number of other businesses I think you can talk about, but those are kind of the ones that have gotten the most attention.
Right.
And so, yeah, quickly, I would think, but we don't know for sure. And it's always hard to kind of figure out which way the judge is leaning. He asked a number of questions. It was more like an appeals court where a lawyer is making the argument and the judge interrupts him or her and says, well, what about this? What about that? But I could not, even with that back and forth, I could not tell which way Judge Gale, who has handled a number of the, I believe he handled the bowling alleys cases and the bar case. So, I mean, he's going to be real familiar with these issues, but I don't know which way he's leaning.
And I'm sure he's right. I'm sure that whichever way it is, there will be an appeal there also.
Maybe we should talk about the political angle of that, though, because no surprise that COVID-19 is going to be the biggest issue probably of the governor's race. But, I mean, Forrest is really setting himself up as the reopen guy. In fact, there is literally a billboard that says Dan Forrest will reopen NC. And he put it out on social media and was like, you bet I will. He's sending out pictures of these events that are indoors, that are maskless. He's shaking people's hands. He is all in on that idea of being the reopen candidate. I don't know how well that polls.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the polls that we're seeing now certainly are very much in favor of the other direction. Who knows, though, by the time fall comes around, people may be really sick of this. You know, it is tough, though, because as we're watching, you know, the states that opened up earliest, you know, now with the largest outbreaks and the most serious problems with overloaded hospitals, it's, pardon me, sorry, there we go. It's kind of hard to make the case at this point that that we didn't go fast enough. And I think Cooper is certainly banking on that going into November, as you say, you know, and is setting himself up to be, you know, the careful one. And he did get a little bit of, he had to have a little schadenfreude this week when it was announced that that President Trump would not be giving his acceptance address in Charlotte, where the GOP, a much smaller GOP convention, is going to take place. And that GOP convention, we learned yesterday, is going to require the attendees to wear masks, which is something that the president felt strongly enough about that that's why he wanted to move it to Jacksonville in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, not that we look to the president of the United States right now for consistency, but I don't know that I've seen a 180 like the president on masks, gone from, you know, kind of dismissing them to patriots wear masks. And I mean, good, I guess, because we're kind of all in on the idea that masks are what's going to get us out of this. But it is, I mean, you know, we're months into this now. So,
yeah. In the meantime, something having nothing to do with the pandemic, shrimp. You wrote this, and this is, to put this in a little bit of context, like North Carolina's commercial fisheries versus recreational fisheries have been a constant source of full-time employment for journalists for many decades, at least as long as I've been here. But most of the fights that I've seen have been over flounder. This particular fight happens to be over shrimp trawling. Shrimp is the state's biggest aquacultural crop.
Yeah, and I mean, they drop the nets in the water, they drag them, and the argument is you're doing too much bycatch, you're catching too many fish that are just killed and thrown away, you're stirring up too much sediment from the ocean bottom, hurting the environment. And this has been an argument for years. And now there's a federal lawsuit. So it'll be interesting to see where it goes. It names most of the big shrimp companies out on the coast, or at least many of them, as well as the state regulators. The Division of Marine Fisheries was filed Tuesday of this week, I believe. So we'll see where that goes.
It's not even pandemic. It's not even really about politics, since the defendants in this case are of both parties. And come from across so do the plaintiffs. So fascinating to watch this. We did a big documentary a couple of years back called Net Effect. We looked at how this has played out with flounder. So if you want to see that, we did a pretty good job of it. Our documentary crew did. You can find that on WRL.com.
Yeah, and it's actually attached to the post we put up about this lawsuit today, Thursday.
Perfect.
So if you just go to NC Capitol, find that story. The doc is right there at the top of it.
In the meantime, a couple of legislators that we thought we wouldn't be seeing anymore, turns out we will. That is Jerry Tillman. He is a Stanley County Republican senator who stepped down rather, quickly during end of session in June or July, I guess that was. And then we also had Andy Wells, who ran for lieutenant governor, did not win the nomination, and so was going to have to retire at the end of his term. We learned that both of those are going to be appointees to the DOT board by Senate Leader Phil Berger. You know, Travis, it's funny because back in 2013, the big push was to take the politics out of the DOT board, right? And now it's like, get them back in.
Yeah, and I mean, some of the reforms that they were talking about the last time they met, there were questions about, well, how much more power goes to the DOT board versus staff versus the various formulas that are supposed to spit out what roads get done. If you ain't got enough money to do everything the formula says, somebody's going to make some decisions there. So it'll be interesting to see what happened. Boy, Jerry Tillman and Andy Wells, two tougher cross-examiners, I don't know that you could have picked out of the Senate with ease.
Well, it definitely boosted the news value of those meetings, we'll put it that way.
Yeah, that's the way. But on the House side, Chuck McGrady's going to go to the DOT board. Don't know exactly when it will be. He said he's going to work on the next budget, which is probably September. But the speaker announced that he plans to appoint McGrady to that one of the House seats. And I think there's still a couple of appointments that are left. Steven Rosenberg is another House appointment. He's a Charlotte real estate guy to the DOT board. But I think there may be two seats still to be announced from the House.
Yeah, they each get three. So that's interesting. And you know, McGrady is also is another one who had announced that he wasn't going to run for re-election. So
yeah. It told me, I did not know this, used to be on the Board of Transportation in Georgia.
Yep. So he has the background for it, that's for sure. In the meantime, another story that we should, as long as we're talking legislature, let me go back to this real quick. We learned this week that it looks like Destin Hall may be the new rules chair to replace David Lewis. Representative David Lewis obviously announcing recently that he is not going to be running for re-election. Destin Hall, younger, obviously, an attorney. Is he, what am I thinking? No, Catawba? No, he's not Catawba County. Burke.
Oh, boy, don't put me on the spot there. I'm not going to be able to nail that one.
I apologize. Maybe Cleveland. But it's out. He's a Western Republican attorney who certainly carried some water for some fairly big bills at the legislature. And so he will be, I guess, filling in along with the other folks like John Torbett, for example, that have been helping to man the Rules Committee. For those of you who aren't kind of aware, the Rules Committee is a huge job. It is the way that the things are set up under this leadership organization anyway. So, you know, it's not surprising that they need plenty of brain power and a pretty smart attorney on there. Certainly doesn't hurt.
Yeah, and kind of naming the heir apparent after Lewis. It's interesting that, you know, they're doing this now before Lewis actually leaves. And we really don't know necessarily whether or not Republicans will hold the majority next year in the House. I think they've got a good shot at it, but you don't need a new rules chair necessarily next year if you're a Republican. So it'll be interesting to see how that goes. I wonder if there's some people who feel a little passed over by this, but Destin Hall is kind of an obvious up-and-comer in the House Republican caucus, and this makes it even more obvious.
Yeah. Looks like, okay, oh, you also did a story about those utility cutoff, and this has been another one of those points of conflict between some of the Republicans on the Council of State, notably Republican Treasurer Del Falwell, and Governor Cooper regarding those utility, the utility deferments that were allowed under the pandemic order. So those have expired as of the end of July. They said that was really important to a lot of these smaller sort of city-owned, publicly owned utilities, the cities around the state who provide the electric service, the water service, sewer, sometimes even the, you know, the internet cable service to their customers. There was a lot of perception that this was going to help people with the big folks like your Duke or your Dominion, but it turned out to be really causing some major budget holes for these smaller utilities. So that pause has sort of ended, but not entirely for the big guys, at least according to the Utilities Commission, right?
Yeah, the Utilities Commission regulates the big guys, the for-profit entities, or Duke Energy, Dominion, what you would think of as your power company. And they're saying, you know, that they're going to extend their moratorium, I believe, another month. Don't quote me on that. Whereas the smaller ones, the city-owned ones, your local water department, they can start cutting people off. But they are supposed to offer payment plans first.
Yeah, they're supposed to offer like a six-month payment plan, I think is what that was for the smaller utilities. And I think for the larger utilities, they were talking about 1 year, possibly.
Yeah. I think the upshot for customers is that you may, if you have it in your mind that there's one rule for all the utilities with this moratorium, that is no longer the case. There are different rules based on what sort of regulation they fall under. You can see the story we put up, or just reach out to your utilities if you owe money.
So what are you watching next week?
Next week, that's a good question. I mean, I got a story that's going to be coming out about some more intrigue in the bail bonds world. So look for that one.
That is the story, the gift that keeps on giving. Oh my gosh. Yeah.
And, you know, assuming I survive that writing process, I we're really into the political season now, and it's so much different because of COVID-19.
So quiet.
we mentioned that Forrest is obviously doing events, but the governor was asked at one of his press conferences this week if he was going to do any in-person events, and he said no. And he didn't say, you know, I won't do a single one until, you know, after the election. But that was kind of the way I took it, was foreseeable future. Do not expect Roy Cooper to be holding in-person campaign events. I'm sure the fundraising train online and over the phone is
going just fine. Sure.
Yeah, they don't seem to have any problems raising money over there. So that's kind of the dynamic that I think is interesting. And I mean, how does that translate though to a local house race, for example, or if you're a judge running and you do you decide not to go to a Rotary Club where, I mean, who knows who their local judges are, you know? I mean, their retail politics are such a big part of some of these races. So I don't know how you get around that and how you balance that if you feel like you cannot be in a crowd right now.
Yeah, that, and, you know, I mean, you have to balance that. You know, is it worthwhile to get your supporters jazzed up, to get your name out there, to get some checks? Because, I mean, let's face it, these in-person rallies do help with fundraising, versus the possibility of making your supporters sick. The people who are the people that you're counting on to go knock on doors for you and show up and help people get to the polls. So I think it's a complicated political calculus. And I think we're seeing, well, we'll see which one worked, I guess, come November. So
if it's one thing about politics, you know, they always doing the calculus. So.
Right. By the way, Dustin Hall, I think, is Caldwell County. Sorry. It just came to mind. Sorry. Anyway, well, that's about it for me. I'm going to be watching Education Oversight is coming back on Monday. We're going to be looking at some of the school stuff. Obviously, there's a lot of schools that are not going back at all for the first few weeks, are online only. It'll be interesting to see what the oversight people have to say about that, what kind of questions they have for DHHS and DBI, who I would expect will probably be talking at this thing. And so that's sort of the first of the August round of oversight meetings. So I'm sure we'll be, you know, as the pandemic comes and goes and hurricane season comes and goes, I'm sure we'll be seeing some interesting discussions.
Yeah, sounds about right.
All right. Well, Travis, anything else you want to add?
No, I think we covered it. Oh, real quick. We have a sentencing date now for Greg Lindbergh, John Gray, and Robin Hayes, August 19th in Charlotte. I'm sure most people are familiar with that bribery case. They are going to be sentenced on the 19th of August. So that'll be kind of the next thing to get reported on that, I believe.
Stay tuned, and thank you for joining us.
This podcast is a production of WRAL.com, part of the Capital Broadcasting Podcast Network. If you like the show, we'd appreciate you giving us a review and sharing it with your friends. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your favorite listening app.